Funding for Think comes from SMU Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to an archive edition of Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Is it possible to combat violence with little more than a commitment to peace and justice? As a young mother in war-ravaged Liberia, Lema Bowie was tired of hearing her own children cry from hunger, seeing other women's children armed as soldiers, and hearing the heartbreaking stories of husbands and fathers killed and wives and mothers raped. She had few resources to mount a campaign for peace, but recognized the raw power of harnessing the energy of other women, sick to death of watching their country destroyed by warlords. Bowie played such a significant role in the 2003 conclusion of the Second Liberian Civil War. She was awarded the Nobel Peace Prize in 2011. She writes about her experiences in her memoir, Mighty Be Our Powers, How Sisterhood, Prayer, and Sex Changed a Nation at War. Lema, welcome to Think.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
So you were just 17 when the first civil war broke out in Liberia. Before we get to the effects of that, can you tell us a little bit about what you remember of Liberia from when you were a child?
Well, one of the things that I remember as a young child was growing up in a community of multi-ethnicity, different religious groups, different economic backgrounds, just people, a mixture. Maybe you call it a little rainbow community. Mm-hmm. And it was in an urban area, but it had a rough flavor. The reason I say that is because when we were growing up in that community, there was a very wealthy Liberian family who owned the entire area and they sold off bits and pieces. You could go to those wealthy people's house and have a meal and then leave from there, come home, and their children would come. The rich woman, best friend was my grandmother and another woman. But then if we went to play and by five, we were still at a neighbor's house, they would bathe us.
Mm-hmm.
And if we came from school, because the houses, you could stand on our back porch and look at someone's front porch. So we were always shouting across to each other, what did they cook at your house? And someone would say they made palm butter, and that was my favorite. And then I would say they made cassava leaves. Can we swap meals? And yes. So they'll come over, or sometimes they'll say, okay, let's just share. So you eat some of mine, I eat some of yours. It was really, really a happy place. Parents, regardless of whose parent it was, would discipline you. So if you went to someone's house and misbehaved, they would discipline you. We were Christians. My family went to the Lutheran church and still do. And the next door, my closest friends were Muslims. Whenever it was Ramadan, they would wear new clothes. And my mother had to buy me something new. It was almost like no one. And Christmas came and the Muslim children would dress up like Christian children. Mm-hmm. One of also my fondest memory was that there was this big tree. And there was a space under the tree where we would play. As children, after school, there was an old car. The driver of that car used to be called Mr. Mark, and the car got spoiled. But my sister, Mala, would climb in that car, and then she would say, I am like the conductor collecting. And the money we used to pay to get on the old car, other kids, would be candy wrap.
Mm-hmm.
And you would hear me shouting all of the counties in Liberia, because that was where all of the children in that neighborhood came from.
Mm-hmm.
Bon County was where we came from, Lofa, Nimbak, all the way. And then, so you had to get certain paper wrap, and it was children would gather paper wrap because they wanted to get in that old car, even though it wasn't moving, but it was like an imaginary trip to their rural villages. It was just a really happy place. And growing up, we really didn't know which ethnic group was which ethnic group.
Mm-hmm.
So we were all just one people.
Then you're 17, you finish high school. Education was really important to your family, but everything changed for you quite literally overnight.
Yeah. When we graduated from high school, the war started like a day after graduation. And people would come and say, war is coming. My parents would say, that's not true. My mother lived in a state of denial for many months, because she had been socialized to believe that Liberia was the perfect place.
Mm-hmm.
No one would kill any innocent person. Her social, her belief in her country was just unshakable, like many people believe in their communities. And then one day she left to go to work. And in like, I stayed back because my classes at the university were for late afternoon. So I had to stay back and take care of the younger ones shooting. There was this old man who was internally displaced in our home. And then he said, I know that sound. The rebels have come, because he came from northern Liberia where the fighting was already ongoing. And in like a matter of seconds, rains of bullets, something we had never experienced before. All of a sudden at 17, woke up in the morning dependent on your parents. And in less than an hour, you're an adult. You have to take decisions for security for your younger siblings. In few hours, you have over 25 people who are coming over because they go to the same church or work with your parents, and they are displaced because their homes are under attack. And you have to organize lodging for them, feeding for them, and then look through your parents' things to see what is important and what is not important, and keep the keys to their bedroom. That was it automatically. And from that day till I'm 40 today, I've never gone back to being that teenage girl.
So you became a mother during the years of the first Liberian Civil War. And there was that point when you realized that your children had never, not only not known a childhood like your own, they hadn't known a day without fear, without hunger. Can you talk about that?
I had my first son. I got pregnant in 1992. In 1992, we had just gone through another period of war called the Operation Octopus. That's when the Taylor and his men decided to attack Monrovia from different angles. So think about the octopus, the many hands. Mm. So everywhere there was bombing. And we were moving from place to place, place to place.
And this is just a crowded city where this is all happening.
It said that I was built for 250,000 people, that had over 1 million people in there. And then I go into labor in early 93. It's still curfew. So you have a dog stood down, no one can come outside kind of situation happening. I got into labor at 12 midnight, and we couldn't leave the house to go to a doctor till almost 7 in the morning. Mm. We get there, this child is born, and he's born in a tent because that was a makeshift hospital. We come back home, and, you know, just after having another child and burying another child, but the fear, constant fear that we live in, one, two, food was an issue. Every other day, you had to struggle for food. By the time I was carrying my third child, another war broke out in 1996. And we had to walk 7 hours from where we were to another place. And for days, we couldn't find food to eat. By the time we made it back to Ghana at the refugee camp, I was in and out of the hospital like 10 times a month, or more than that, or 10 times every 2 weeks, with malaria, anemia. I was less than 60 pounds. Hmm. So I was a virtual skeleton. I remember coming one day from the doctor and there was heavy wind. I told my sisters later on that the wind virtually picked me up and threw me somewhere else. Having those children and just seeing my daughter, when we moved in 96 to Ghana as refugees, every time a tire fired, she would shut her eyes and scream. And her eyes would remain shut for maybe 30 minutes. And we had to gradually talk to her, mm-hmm. to say nothing has happened. We're not in a war anymore. We are at a safe place. But every time whilst we're in Liberia, there was shooting. That was her reaction. So even in a refugee situation, she still felt like she was in a war, you know, war environment. So she would shut her eyes, like to shut out the madness, shut out the pains or the evil. No one wants to have children in that kind of situation. Yeah.
How do you even try to maintain something that feels normal for yourself and for your children? I mean, what did you do during those times when there actually was danger to try and live like a normal human being?
Well, most time I just spend the time talking to the children. We had different things that we kept with them. Like my son had a very hot pink pillow that he used to love. Someone bought it when they thought I was having a girl. And we ran in 96 because he was attached to that pillow. So he's almost three, or he's 3 years old, and he's had that pillow every day of his life. And when we ran, we forgot the pillow.
Hmm.
And it was like his world was shattered.
Yeah.
Because his pillow was gone. I remember 3 days of crying and 3 days of his father trying to walk from where my parents was to go back to a very dangerous community for a pink pillow. We never got the pillow back, but we some days we'll sing to them, read stories to them, talk with them. But it's you can never create. All you can do is try to shelter them. I remember the morning in 96 we were walking. We were constantly covering their eyes because there were bodies all along the street. And they would ask questions. They would say they're hungry. They want something to drink. Where are we going? Those kinds of things. And then when we went to the refugee camp, my daughter, who was 2 at the time, would constantly say, where is grandma?
Hmm.
Where is everyone? Why are we here? When are we going back home?
And you can't answer those questions.
You can never answer because you don't know whether you're going back home or you're not going back home. And sometimes they, because we lived not in the state that we live in as refugees. We were living in a single room. We had a mattress on the floor. And the window we had a big hole in it. So we had to put cloth where we live as refugees. And Mama, where is your bed? Why don't we have food? Those kinds of, you know, questions. Constant questions. So the only stability I provided for them was my faith. Every Sunday, they would go to church. And I was trying to build a world around them, sheltered. But it's something that you can never really do in the midst of uncertainty.
At what point did it occur to you, maybe from the beginning, that women very rarely are at the front of wars? Women are not fighting the wars, but it is women and children who suffer in war.
Well, in my own experience, when we moved in 1990, I was a girl of 17. We went to Ghana. My mother had 10 people to look after. But even before we moved there, it was very dangerous for the young boys who were not fighters to come out. So they stay indoors. So in that, we had to go out to search for food. In the process, you could get raped. In the process, but no one ever thought about the danger to you as a young person. I was the one who would carry money from one side of the war zone to my grandmother. And I remember they would pack. And if you were caught with money, it was something else. And every time I had to cross maybe 20 checkpoints, very dangerous checkpoints, they made the money like sanitary pad.
Mm-hmm.
And I carry it in my underwear. But this is a trip that I had to make. It wasn't questionable. No one thought that. I had other siblings, but somehow everyone felt like I was the strong one. My dad called me in the taxi. And then I was the one who was always looking for food. So you keep going, 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 and it's never ending.
My guest is Lema Bowie. She's a human rights activist and recipient of the 2011 Nobel Peace Prize. Her book is called Mighty Be Our Powers, How Sisterhood, Prayer, and Sex Changed a Nation at War.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program, accepting applications for this fall to design your own Master of Liberal Studies degree at SMU with concentrations in global studies, creative writing, and organizational dynamics. You can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to an archive edition of Think. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is human rights activist Lema Bowie. She's a recipient of the 2011 Nobel Peace Prize and author of the book Mighty Be Our Powers, How Sisterhood, Prayer, and Sex Changed a Nation at War. So one of the first actions that you could take was to simply join your friends and your neighbors in praying for peace. And there are people who would say that that doesn't feel like action, but for you it was action.
Well, it was because first I had been working with child soldiers and going from place to place and just seeing some of the effects of the war, even though the war was still ongoing. And out of the clear, I can't say I was a real faithful Christian, but I have had this vivid dream about putting women together to pray for peace. And I went to work and told my colleague and my boss, who was a pastor, and said, well, you need to tell your church women to pray. And he was like, no, the dream bearer is the dream carrier.
And that's you.
Yes. We brought this group of women together every Tuesday at 12 noon, and we pray for peace. As we began to pray, really, it wasn't just praying all day. Sometimes someone will come and give an inspirational word. And then we started reading of Christian women in the Bible who had done great things to transform their society. And I would think that really the divine lesson God was telling, really bringing us to a place where ordinary women who felt like they had no stake, you know, in any of the politics or changing their communities, from their angle, which was their faith angle, needed to know that sometimes God truly used ordinary people to make great changes. So after 1 year, the Muslim women decided to do the same thing. After a year, all of them came together and decided they wanted to do outreach to other women in the markets, in the mosques, in the churches, to let them know about the power of women according to what they've been learning over the last year. And then when these women came together, that number grew from like 50 to almost 200. And later on, we moved to other parts of the place. So that's how we really started. So it was just prayers and then later on, greater things.
We'll talk about those greater things in a couple of minutes. I want to go back to this issue of child soldiers, which was work that you had done for a number of years. First of all, what does it take to recognize that these children are victims as much as they are aggressors?
Listen to their stories. Step out of your perception, seeing them as the evil people. That's what I did when I started working with them. I hated them. These were the people who turned my world upside down. These were the people who were responsible for the death of my schoolmates, my friends. And then when their guards were down, even though they were 16, you were looking straight at a 7-year-old boy, because that was when he got involved in the crisis, crying frantically, I want to see my mother, I want to see this person, I want to see that person. But then step back and ask them about their stories. How did they get involved? One of the little boys named Sam Brown, I met Sam when he was 15. And this was 1999. So at 15, it meant he was like, 8, 9 years old when he got conscripted. His mother had many children. What he remembers is that shooting erupted in the village and everyone scattered. He stayed back, lost. Think about an average 9-year or 8-year old boy in chaos. He would not know what to do. And so he stayed back, and one of the fighters took him. After several months of carrying stuff for this fighter, they introduced him to drugs and guns, and later on sent him out to do his first killing and his first human heart eating. So this is somebody...
Excuse me, human heart eating.
Yes, that was part of the ritual of getting them involved. So you have to kill someone and then open up their heart, eat it up. They had all kinds of drink blood of initiating these children into some of these things. He went through all of that process. By 15, he had one arm cut off, and he's a drug addict till today. He was very hard and felt he was a man, but actually these were boys forced to be men. He had never really grown up. There was something missing. And every time the drug cleared from his eyes, or the alcohol was not there, you saw that 8-year-old boy trapped into the body of a 15-year-old that had been exploited. And if gradually I got to understand these children, and I said to myself, especially when I had children, if you took my 8-year-old and put a gun in his hands, gave him drugs, he's a victim. He didn't ask to be there, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And that's how I started recognizing and really not falling in love, but being and having empathy for them and really being compassionate towards them. Till today, a lot of them and I still have a relationship. At 15, Sam had a baby by another very little girl, 14 years old. And the two of them, they didn't know what to do with the little boy. One day he brought him and laid him on my desk. Take him. Eventually, we relocated his mother, and the mother has taken this baby. But he's never been rehabilitated. Today, he's still high on crack. Anything he can get, he's still onto that. But when he's really depressed and there's no crack or anything and you're talking to him, you still see the 8-year-old boy trapped in the body of that man.
Well, you have this whole generation now of young people in Liberia who don't know life, who can't remember life before these things were part of their lives. And now you have there's infrastructure destroyed. And I know that there's been a great deal of progress made in the past 9 years. But talk a little bit about how you begin to rehabilitate not just individuals, but an entire traumatized generation.
That is the biggest challenge that we have, not just as a country, but as a region, West Africa. Because you have the Liberian phenomenon, you have the Sierra Leonean, quite recently the Cote d'Ivoire phenomenon. And it's really, it's just a whole generation of militarized youth. Easy prey, mercenaries ready to go out to fight because they know nothing. They can't be employed. They have no skills. The only employment they know is the barrel of the gun. What do you do? I think it's time, and we haven't done a lot of that, that we really focus on this generation of lost boys, if you want to call them that, and deliberately start programs that will address some of the issues. I've been working with these children on and off for all of these years. Now I don't engage with them the way I used to. My only engagement with them is if I'm driving on down the street, they see me, I stop my car, we have a whole long conversation. I know babies that were born when I work with them. How is this junior boy? How is this person? And then if they have need for anything, I give it to them. You still see that longing to be accepted. Many of them are rejected by their communities. So there are several steps that people, the government, people concerned like myself can take to deliberately get them to a place where they understand. You have all of these conversations happening about taking a nation out of poverty, out of the state of war, into development and progress. No one ever invites them to any of these conversations. So that is a serious, and the awakening moment for us as Liberians was this past elections when we had a riot. These were the young people who took to the streets and really just started burning people's cars because that's the only lifestyle they know. And the other thing that I say to people is that it's easier for them to do these things because, of course, if I have no stake in this radio station and you needed someone to destroy it, I will be the first person because you haven't made me to really feel like I'm a part of this community.
Mm-hmm.
If you make me to feel like all of these glass buildings that you're putting up, the roads that you're constructing, I have a stake and I can benefit from it, I will want to protect it. But if I feel like I don't have anything to do with any of these things, why do? And that's the situation. Till today, we still talk about employment, providing jobs for the youth population in Liberia. But when they talk about the youth population, they're also talking about a lot of those young people who didn't fight. We still have this generation that no one is looking at. What these boys have done, they formed themselves into an amputee soccer squad. They are the current champions of Africa from Liberia. But that's the only way out. And it's just like a handful of them, about 30 of them. You have dozens more in different parts of Liberia with needs. The way it now, some of them die from AIDS as a result of the needles that they use to take drugs and different things. And people are not very compassionate to them. They still don't see them as victims. A lot of our community people, and it's something that they may be right because of the pains that people felt at the hands of some of these young people. But if we really sit and do a deeper analysis, I think sometimes the anger is, or the way people are angry is misdirected.
So, Lema, before you had the global voice that you have today, you really wanted to make it known, you and the other women that you were working with and praying with, that you had had enough of this violence. And so you did something that strikes us as very simple, but ultimately was quite powerful. You demonstrated every day.
Well, you see, one of the things that we did was simply put our bodies out there. Because in the privacy of our communities, we were being raped, generally as women. In the privacy of our communities, we were the ones watching babies die. I had to look at my 3-year-old beg for a piece of donut, and you can't give it to him. I had to see my daughter suffer from severe malaria convulsing because we had been on a ship that was unhealthy for many days. We were the ones seeing everything. We were the ones really just bearing it. Every day through the checkpoints going to look for food, we were the ones being stripped naked because at some point the fighters realized that women were carrying money like sanitary pads. Mm-hmm. So they were stripping everyone naked to make sure you didn't have money that you were carrying to some other place. They have a saying, he or she who's down fears no fall. And that's the situation we find ourselves in. So if we sit, we will die. If we rise up, we might die. But the difference is that in rising up, there may be a story that this group of women tried and they made a change. And that was the drive for us. So we decided to put ourselves out there. We were out there every day for 2.5 years. Even after the peace agreement was signed, we still went out there because we felt like many peace agreements had been signed in Liberia. But it was important for us to be there to see that the guns were taken from the boys and that other things were happening for other people.
Yeah, because it's one thing to have a piece of paper. It's another thing to have actual peace put in place. And when there's this point where the warlords are meeting initially, and you were not willing to trust that they were going to go off to Ghana and have a conversation and come back with something fruitful.
Well, by the time they started, first Taylor had his demands that he had things that he was saying. President Taylor, Charles Taylor, yeah. He was saying he will not go to peace talks because the rebels were terrorists and he was a sovereign president and was a sovereign nation, all kinds of things. So we had to put pressure on him to agree to go to the talks. We had to put pressure on the rebels from different angles for them to also go to the talks. But then when they went to the talks, we also was really, really aware, we were aware that people going to talks didn't really mean that peace would come. And if we just let them go to the talks, it could be months and years of nothing happening. So we decided to accompany them to the talks. So we went to the talks and protested too. We're out there while some women were in Liberia. But after the signing of the peace agreement, but one of the turning points of the talks was that at some point, no one was doing anything. And one of the days we got tired and just locked everyone in. When we locked them in, they decided to come and arrest me. And honestly, for me, that beautiful community that I shared with you at the beginning of this program really collapsed before me. I grew up knowing a Liberia that would protect women and children. I grew up knowing a place where those hurt, where something was done to pacify them. I grew up knowing a community where people just love other people. It was a shared humanity. There was generosity of spirit. And then a group of military men saying to me they were going to arrest me because I stood up for the rights of my people. I thought that was the peak of, you know, throwing away everything I believed in. And I felt, what more disgrace can you get than being arrested for standing up for peace? So I decided to strip naked. And everyone ran because, again, when you're in pain and stripping in Africa, it's a curse. So we got to the place where people became sober. 2 weeks later, a peace agreement was signed. We went back to Liberia and asked ourselves, do we stop? And the answer was a resounding no. Let's sit down, take this document, and they say if you want to hide things from women, put it in a bulky document. This is like 300 pages. We sat down, went through that document for 3 days and set benchmarks So we just simplify the entire peace agreement from this month to this month. This will be happening. If you don't see it happening in your community, protest. So we use that as a mobilizing tool again for the women. And it was really very effective.
Has it changed your view of humanity to know that you grew up in this place that was peaceful and protected women and children and communities came together? Having witnessed how fast it can change, how people that you knew to be good people can turn and do very bad things. I mean, does that stain forever the way you look at other human beings?
Well, it hasn't stained the way I look at other human beings, because I believe that when we grow up, or are growing up in a specific place, or this world has two things, good and evil. And sometimes evil takes over good. And the reason why evil takes over good is when good people sit back and allow evil to take over. Look at the population of Liberia, 3-something million people. What was the population of the fighters? The good people were more than the evil people. Mm-hmm. The reason why the evil people prevailed for 14 years was because the good people refused to take action. That's the first thing. The second thing, the conclusion I've come to is that as a result of my experience, I would never want to socialize my children to believe that the world is perfect. I want them to know that there are things in this world that they will encounter that will challenge every good thing that we've taught them. But those good things that they've been taught, this should be the driving force for standing up.
My guest is Lema Bowie. She's a human rights activist and recipient of the 2011 Nobel Peace Prize. Her memoir is called Mighty Be Our Powers: How Sisterhood, Prayer, and Sex Changed a Nation at War. Listening to an archive edition of Think on KERA 90.1, I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is human rights activist and Nobel Peace Prize recipient Lema Bowie. She's author of the memoir Mighty Be Our Powers: How Sisterhood, Prayer, and Sex Changed a Nation at War. Our number is 1-800-933-5372. Let's go on the phones now to Louisa Nefertiti in Dallas. Hi, Louisa.
Oh, God bless you, ladies. My sisters and my sister, I'm from Liberia, one of the Flama Shamas of Back to Love. I'm just so moved by God using your vessel, you know, to turn adversity into stars, you know. And I could cry because in 1979, I wrote a song called Africa Don't Make War. Everybody thought I was crazy. And then during the war, the DJs called and said, Louisa, your song prophesied the Liberian War. The next year, my son was murdered on the beach in Liberia, Rafael. And I just found a tape of him singing, Lift Me Up, Lord. And I was working on my own book, and I heard you, and I said, I got to call and just express my love and gratitude to you for all you did. And I'm glad that my son was not a child soldier. Maybe he would have been one. But I just love you, and thank you so much for everything you're doing.
Thanks so much for your call. Did you want to respond to that at all? I mean, I obviously it's another sort of story of someone who can relate.
Well, that's the everyday story of the nation we come from. Stories of pain, stories of mothers who lost their children to total madness of men's greed. But, I mean, losing a son, to execution or whatever, is totally, maybe in a different way, but somehow similar to those mothers who had their sons become child soldiers. Because one of the women I interacted with, her son I've worked with for many years, she's refused to take him back home because of the atrocities he committed in the community. And she said her whole life is about her community. And anyone who threatens the community, she will never deal with. That's one. Two, when she had her son, he had two legs. This boy is an amputee as a result of his involvement in the war. He had a baby by a girl, and this child was a boy. They were going through such tough times, the girl left the baby with him and went. So we went back to that community and said, your son has a child. And she said, I will take the child, but I'll never take him back. So when we gave her that baby, she's like, God has compensated me. So for her, he's dead. Mm-hmm. Even though he still lives, but for her, he's totally dead. And she would take care of that baby. The catch there is he cannot interact with the child. He's agreed to it. But many women lost their children at the hands of these children but many mothers lost their sons because of the perpetrators of this war.
Do you worry about the generation of young women coming of age now in Liberia who will marry these young men, who will have children with them?
I worry more about the children that these young men are having and the narratives that are being handed down to these children. A lot of these boys tell their children, we were the heroes. You see that big building there? We fought to make this building big. And today, we are not enjoying it. It's Lima's children that are enjoying it. Look at my life. I fought for peace all of my life. I was never a warlord. So you know that just hypothetically, there will be a whole generation of young children who will be angry at successful people their ages. Because in their minds, they've been socialized to believe by their parents that these children, regardless of which family you come from, our parents fought for your parents, and we are not benefiting. Tomorrow, we will see a resurgence, maybe 50 years, 60 years from now, that generation of child soldiers' children who may be, if nothing is done, in a state of poverty. And our children that we're fighting to educate coming back. So now you see the situation of the American-Liberian versus indigenous. It's going to be a shift. Children of those who fought versus children of those who did not get involved in the war.
So how do we, if the seeds have been planted for future conflict, what do you do to get in the middle of that?
We need to first start working with these child soldiers, ex-child soldiers, to make sure that at least their economic state comes to a level where they're able to appreciate other people and appreciate the nation called Liberia. But beyond that, I think there needs to be an intensive peace, kind of peace education program for young children, including children of fighters. There also, we are at a place in Liberia where we do not have a singular narrative on why we fought. So if you ask me as a Pele person, that's my ethnic group, I will tell you it in a way that is favorable or make my ethnic group to look like the group victims. If you ask another group, they will tell you it in a way that makes the ethnic groups to look like the victims. So then we're still planting the seeds of division until we come together as a people and deliberately say, this is our singular narrative. We all got mad at some point. We all did something terrible, really collectively taking responsibility. Because what I say to Liberians as I travel back and forth, there is not a single home in Liberia that someone will say, I didn't lose a relative as a result of the war. And there is not a single home in Liberia that someone will say, I don't have a relative that was a fighter.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. We have Jock on the line in Dallas now. Hello, Jock.
Hello, Chris. How are you?
Very well, thank you.
Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
Just want to comment on the war in Liberia. I'm actually from Sudan, and I was really a young man back then in the 90s when the war was going on. And, you know, to me, I mean, we have seen so many atrocities across the continent of Africa. And, you know, it's really striking. And we continue to live with those pain in our life. And one of the things that strikes me the most sometimes is, you know, when the young people came into this country, they tend to forget what our parents have gone through and how we can correct those things, you know, in our life to continue with a prosperous nation. And I just want to put that comment across.
Thanks for your call.
Well, Jack is so right. I go around a lot, and I just said to a group of women at this brunch that when I come to countries like the U.S. and go to other places, I'm not looking for the high-rise building. I have a very curious eye looking for a situation that is in need of change. And sometimes I interact with young people, interact with communities in the diaspora, ask many questions. And if you look through the diasporan communities, specifically Liberian communities, the number of young people going to prison, it's alarming. And I tend to ask myself why. And sometimes, in some instances, I lay the blame squarely on the shoulders of the adults who bring these children to some of these places. And I may be wrong for this assumption, but, and tend to say, oh, you see that child misbehaving? That's an American child. I can't discipline him, you know, because the people have rules here. When he steps outside to go to school, for the rest of his life, he's that boy with the accent. He can never really be an American. And then in his house, he doesn't fit with you and your people. So he's in the middle. He's lost. And sometimes the only way is to find young people lost like him who have formed gangs and they want to show that we are the in people, and then it end up, of, you know. But again, I say to myself, okay, check out communities in the diaspora where people still hold on to their traditional values. I have an aunt who lives in Philly. You walk through her door today, there's food on the stove. Anyone who goes into that house knows you have food to eat. But no young man dare walk through her door with his pants sagging. She will make you buckle up neatly before you enter. We still speak Pele when we go to that house. And she still has a firm hand on her children. Two boys, none of them have gone to prison. They live in the worst part of Philadelphia. I tell people that is an example of reminding people of where you came from and the hope of that community in your going back. But when we forget to tell our children the stories of where they came from and the poverty affiliated with those areas, and that they are the hope, there is a name for a group of young people or people who come to places and go back with nothing. They call them bintos. I've been to this place, but you've been to that place. What did you bring back? At the end of the day, this is what you have. Every year, December, we have plane load of young Liberians being deported back home. Can you imagine? We have a population of child soldiers that we haven't dealt with, and now we're getting hard, cold criminals coming back because of their life of crime in this country. He's right. There's something that needs to be done, but I also think an education in where they come from, constantly reminding them and not really saying, oh, you know, you are part of this system. Yes, you're part of this system, but you can never really fit into this system because you always be that child, that man, that woman with the accent.
I want to ask you about something, Lema. You mentioned earlier you're just 40 years old. You are so young. You still have school-age kids. You are. We talked before the show about your schedule, which is crazy. I don't so much want to talk to you about that crazy question we ask women about balance, but I want to ask you if you feel like you have sacrificed and continue to sacrifice time at home and with your children for maybe the children of Liberia and of the world.
I've really done that. I gave a BBC interview, and in that interview, I said to the one interviewing me that one of my regrets, even though it's a regret, but if I had to do it again, I can't change, is that I haven't been around a lot, you know, for those precious times with my children. My third son, Arthur, is a real big follower of soccer, and he plays little games, little leagues in the community at school. I've never seen him play. I've never been to any of his games. There are other things that my children love to do, and I'm never around to see them do those things. Now I'm getting to the place where it's a little bit too late, but within my schedule, birthdays are non-negotiable. Mm-hmm. So I don't travel when we have those birthdays, but they've been immense sacrifices, you know. This past December is when it really hit me. There were riots in Monrovia, and we were all in Ghana for Christmas. All my kids were home. And my phone, I have two cell phones, and they were ringing off the hook. And my eldest daughter looked at me and said, Mama, just get on a plane and go back to Liberia. Because it was almost like with all of these telephone conversations, we know your heart is not here. Mm-hmm. We know you want to go back. You want to be involved. This is what you live for. I went in the room. I sat down. I came back outside without the telephones. And I said, I'm not going anywhere. Whatever is happening in Liberia, we'll wait when I get there. Whatever I can do, I will do. I have to make a confession. I would secretly go into the room to read my text messages and to answer my calls.
Yeah.
But I felt like that was a moment where I had to prove to them that they were more important than any other thing. And I think that challenge to me from my daughter was to say, today, draw the line, you know. But there's no drawing the line. And I think we've come to the place now where there's an understanding that it's not that my work is more important than you are, but my work is going to ensure that you don't have to sacrifice your children and your time in the future. So I'm just helping to create a space for you to be able to function like a normal parent, because the space is not created for me and my sisters in the region to function like normal parents.
So you have this great talent for communicating now, thanks to the Nobel Prize and other things. People know who you are and want to hear what you have to say. Do you ever wake up in the morning and think, oh, God, why me? Why did you choose me for this work?
Well, every day I forget that I'm a Nobel laureate.
No one else does, but you do.
I forget. I seriously forget. Mm-hmm. I will walk into a space and there is all this pomp and pageantry, and I'm wondering, who is it for? You know, why are they here? I was in France. My sister lived in the south of France. And like every migrant grandparent, she does low-skilled jobs. She cleans homes and take care of old people working in the old age home. And has a daughter in one of the local high schools. And in December, she went back to school. And the teacher asked her, you were absent for several days. And she said, yes, I went to Oslo. My aunt was being awarded the Nobel Prize. They didn't believe it. So I was asked to go and speak at that school. We struggled between jeans and t-shirt and everything. I got to the school and there was TV crew. And then I was looking at my sister and said, why are they here? She said, you're a Nobel laureate. I forget.
My guest has been Nobel laureate Lema Bowie. Her memoir is called Mighty Be Our Powers, How Sisterhood, Prayer, and Sex Changed a Nation at War. Lema, it's been such a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Chris. You make interviewing me very easy. Thank you so much. It's been my pleasure.
Thank you. Today's show was engineered by Shelley Canavy. Joe Bilotti answers the phones. Christine McConnell produces the podcast. And our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. You can download that podcast at kera.org/think. And you can email comments to think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.